Being an artist can be a heck of a ride, but you're not alone. On Journey of the Art, we tell inspiring stories of artists and chat with those who support us on this path. I'm your host, Lola Opatayo, writer, editor, singer, and all-round lover of words. Come with me on the journey.
My name's Amanda Eke. Welcome to the Poet Speaks podcast, where we talk all things spoken word.
I come from a generation who wasn't allowed to get their words out.
I want to celebrate. There's no place else to put them. They don't stop. It doesn't turn on.
I would probably explode.
I don't have to. There's no choice.
I need to get my words out because I need to live. And in order to live, I have to express myself.
I'm Dara Kalima, the community poet.
And I am Tony Two Eyes, the entrepreneur-poet.
Join us for Word to Words, the Poets Podcast, where we two poets come together to share our love for words and those who use them creatively. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast.
And also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, all at Word to Words. And that's W-O-R-D, the number two, W-O-R-D-Z. So tune in so you will never miss a word from us.
You're listening to the Ethically Immoral Podcast, Volume 7, Chapter Number 4. Peace and blessings, creatives, peace and blessings. My name is Mike Payne, and I am the host here. Thank you so much for dropping by. Thank you for listening. Always appreciate your presence. Please visit our website, ethicallyimmoralpodcast.com. ethicallyimmoralpodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at ethicallyimmoral. At ethicallyimmoral on Instagram. On Threads at ethicallyimmoral. Follow us on Facebook at Ethically Immoral Podcast. At Ethically Immoral Podcast on Facebook. On X at Poetry and Convo. At Poetry and Convo on X. You can follow us on TikTok at Ethically Immoral Pod. At Ethically Immoral Pod on TikTok. And if you have a question, a comment, a constructive criticism, and or a compliment, feel free to email the program. Our email address is podcast at ethicallyimmoralpodcast.com. Podcast at ethicallyimmoralpodcast.com. All right, coming up, our exclusive conversation with poet, curator, performance poet, and star of the one-woman show, The Long Way Home, Leah V. But before we get into that outstanding conversation with Leah, of course, we want to get into some recorded spoken word performances by fantastic performance poets. Again, my name is Mike Payne. Again, thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the Ethically Immoral Podcast, Volume 7, Chapter Number 4.
I'm thinking, what if I was him? What if that was mine? What if those was folks? How could that be fine? You see that crack his eyes? Out his natural mind, how can six be blind and we react in kind? Did you watch him die? Are we trapped in time? Here we go again. They gonna grab some signs and reenact some lines. Red and blue is gang, killing black is fine. They're still making green, so they relax with lime. They gonna ask for time. We just ask for death. Pick a tree, I'll tag a line. Maybe then we'll tag your lines. Trying to make us great again, but only I want that in mind. I want the whole world covered black. Let's rejoice in classic times. I want to see your folks in shackles. You can trade your past for mine. You could trade your lash for mine. You could teach your kids about black cops on fear and traffic signs. Maybe then we'll catch your lines. This is music for when the war's over. Debt's frozen, maintaining, less coping. More prayer, less hoping. Bonfire with the dread smoking. Less kids with their heads open. Less led to the feds program. More focus, more golden, ear open. Eyes open, live loud and die quoting. These lies provide motion. Big picture, lit scripture. Rich set to get richer. You die trying and get richer. The pro mix is for slow sippers. Lights on, but there's no fixture. Flash going, they gon' pose different. In reality, they know different. See, they nose different. Cameras off and they clothes different. They know fencing, you know fenced in. Looking up, we were both fenced in. Looking down, they're so cinched in. Comments up, slow is slow trending. So sending, mo mending. See if they can meet a slow ending. Trunk pop is always no ending. Op pack for the ghost symptoms. Mask down, cause we know victim. Fuck victim. Either with us or you go with them. Wrong or right, fight or flight. One of a dozen like tiger stripes. Boots on the chimney nowadays just dozen it up in a solid night. Tax free. Axe Bree. Blood for blood. They don't ask me. They just tax me. Put on a badge and harass me. See the facts be. They ain't felt yet. And if you can like Kyle with the AR, then I can like Chris with the Kel-Tec. All your angels been white cause you ain't been living in hell yet. Yet. Thank y'all.
My mother doesn't have a recipe book. When she cooks, it's as if she's preparing for the Last Supper, which is to say she too offers her body in the bread we break at the dinner table. My mother doesn't have a recipe book, but is still able to craft miracles atop plastic counters like the miracle of feeding your family with an empty fridge, the miracle of speaking a love's confession without a single word uttered, the miracle of bringing a man to his knees with nothing but a wooden spoon. And she tells me that these miracles passed down from mother to daughter cannot be written down in anything except a DNA strand. Culture is not an ingredient you could just buy at a grocery store, and the heritage in our hands just won't fit on a spice rack. My mother doesn't have a recipe book in the same way that the universe will never just open its mouth and tell us how it was created. Instead, we must find its origins in the mythology we create out of its constellation skin. And let me tell you, my mother's rice has never tasted so much like stars. Sometimes I think I can taste my mother's sacrifice and how much spice she pours into a boiling pot. Taste my mother's loss and how many placemats she takes away from the dinner table. Taste my mother's love and how she waits for me to take a second bite before she can take her first. And my mother doesn't have a recipe book because she was born with the weight of Eve's apple in the pit of her stomach and found that this is the only way she knows how to pray for forgiveness. It's the only language that came easily to her. So my mother just doesn't have a recipe book. So when I ask her how much oil I should pour into the pan, she laughs, holds me to her chest, tells me to listen to her heartbeat, and to pour that oil until I can no longer hear her pulse. Thank you.
They don't hear me though. Because they'll say all of this is just Martin across the hall. They'll call it ratchet and loud. But I say the flow heavy, Big Shirley, and when I'm around, niggas barely getting ahead now. This articulate, gutter, personified, ow, ebony goddess of ebonics, gun smoke, brown paper bags, laying birders in these baby heads. Damn.
Down by the riverside. Down by
baptism, dark waters, Hennessy, that's Hood Jordan. 2-3 Guinness shaking, 5 black girl hiding a place supposed to be in plain sight. So I heal behind emotional walls. I'm eye candy with jawbreaker punchlines. Chosen cause he chose son. Ordained and ain't luck. My vulnerability, they call it aggressive. They don't appreciate how I dissect the dialect. They don't like how I open up. I got too much thunder in my voice. chicken spot in my cadence. I used to bar hop, now I just spit them. I had to slow down, getting lit to lighten up a bad situation. Lyrical shot sender. Me with no hype, I'm a killer with no gas. I ain't Hitler. White girl on the dance floor. What that mean, Kenny? That mean I move different. Just to make a difference, I'ma do this for my niggas. Us black chicks that got more bars than old gangster pics with no name associates. Yo, I be blackin'. The black girl can win his action. I unleash an outdoor get matching me. Tuh! I'ma leave my all smoky. Cause even when I ain't got enough, I'm making enough, homie. This segment, Ray Lines, endless. They say the vision altered in the way I'm seeing things. I'm taking a big risk. Well, I guess I'm the blind leading the blind, and I'ma have to stick around for a bit. And that's on life. Word to quarter waters, white tees, and black Jesus. I spirit conjured with black girl skin, been crossed so many times, had to pin the shit down just to call it crucifixion. They want me on my knees. Put our bodies behind them, but I mustn't speak them. The only one that's gonna tell me to watch my mouth is my mama. So police and my tongues out of your jurisdiction. Chalk line my diction. Expect me to swallow my pride when my soul cry. Baby girl, you know you was anointed to spit shit. So to God. To God be the glory. For us black chicks that were placed down here to lift souls like phone wires. Necks ringing and wagging fingers, handlebars like BMX riders. Always the riders, but how many times are we expected to die? Until anyone admits that we are actually alive, it got me feeling a way. Black girls are so loud, but never loud enough to be understood. Why they be doing us this way? You want me to straighten up my act and change my posture, but I'ma keep this stance because I said I was feeling a way, conditioned always to accept love, but only if it's tough. So that's when I'ma be giving, writing, getting to the bread that bakes up this penicillin, sharing stories off the walls I built to protect myself. Like, Hyro, listen. Quiet. The next time a black girl say that she gotta use bars and punchlines for her spiritual healing. She may be from a part where they tear that ass apart, but even admitting she has actual feelings, tears, sweat and blood every time I post. So you may try to pass it by, but you ain't gonna take my son. This black girl got way too much shine. So in the end, I give and I give and I always gotta take it back. I said, in the end, I got bars and I give and I always gotta take them back. I'm a big stepper while pulling up my own bootstraps. I leave souls here. I'ma do it for my sisters because family matters. It's Judy wins, never low. I'm all the way up. Don't care about nobody downstairs. I swear to you. I swear to you. This is all a reaction. That every single time I decided to express myself, it was considered aggressive or masculine. I came out the womb birthing the news, so niggas cut on them battle rapper comparisons. Nigga, I'm a poet. A poet who can actually spit like a lady, but one of the realest niggas y'all niggas ever met. That's big facts. Big facts.
All right, welcome back. So the first poem that you heard is entitled, What If I Was Him? And that was performed by Just Ace. You can follow Just Ace on Instagram at @IAM_JustAce. Again, @IAM_JustAce on Instagram. The second poem that you heard is entitled Recipe Book, and that was performed by Arantxa Garcia. You can follow Arantxa on Instagram at arantxa.cgf. Again, at arantxa.cgf on Instagram. And then the third poem that you heard is entitled Like a Lady, and that was performed by friend of the program, Kenny Sings. You can follow Kenny on Instagram at Kenny_sings. Again, at Kenny_sings on Instagram. And that is Kenny. Also, make sure that you check out Kenny's podcast, The Hidden Lines podcast, that she hosts with Smooth Baby. And you can listen to our conversations with Kenny. She appeared in Volume 4, Chapter Number 2, and Volume 1, Chapter 20. All right, my guest this week is a Bronx, New York born, Queens, New York based writer, performance poet, curator, and actress. She holds a BA in English and creative writing, was named the 2019 Poetry Prize winner of the Miller Audio Prize, is a performance poetry coach and guest speaker. The Long Way Home, a spoken word journey, her one-woman spoken word and theatrical poetry show, will be making its second run Friday, April the 24th at the Off-Broadway Triad Theater in New York. Making her first appearance on the program, Leah V. Leah, welcome to the program. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
I haven't been an actress in many years, actually. So I'll explain the whole process of The Long Way Home and why it's everything's been shifting for me. But yes, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, thank you for being here. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Like I told you off air or before we started recording, I've been a fan of yours for a bit. So I've been looking forward to the conversation.
Very exciting, especially considering the time in which you first saw me perform.
Yeah.
Virtually.
Yeah. Virtually. Well, speaking of that, going back to the 2020 COVID era and virtual performances, do you still do virtual performances? Are there any times where you perform virtually, or is that all gone now?
Actually, no. I was about to say it's been a long time, but that's not true. So I am a full-time artist and entrepreneur and so on and so forth. And one of my many eclectic positions to make a living is as the poetry administrator for this HR consulting firm called The Rise Journey. And they have a plethora of clients and that they assist with various HR needs. I believe they have a specialization in DEI, and one of the programs that they offer, that we offer, is like a corporate poetry program. So I'll like curate that, host that, perform there, and it's for like it's like an employee resource group, like virtual all hands kind of deal. But I treat it like a, you know, like an hour long show. And so I get to do that still, which is always a good time, honestly. And I've done a couple solo shows for under that same company. But when it comes to like open mics and stuff, it really died out for me, the virtual open mics, because I mean, anybody in New York who knows me will tell you that I'm outside always.
So when you do those virtual performances or those virtual events, and like I said, you perform, is there a difference in how you approach your performance versus being out performing live for a live crowd?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, when it comes to the company position, which I was talking about, the Rise Poetry Group, I think it's not so much virtual poetry as it is a little bit more, I don't want to say corporate poetry, but there is a little bit of that. Like, it's just, I tend to stem more toward positive, empowering content, poetry, which I have plenty, I have plenty of, you know, which I have plenty of. And these days, to be honest, and this is what I tell people all the time, The Long Way Home is not a sad show. And these days, I do feel like I write joy more than anything else. I mean, so I think that the content matter is a big part. And I love to use my floor space. I think that memorization is more impressive when it's alive. And that's a specialty of mine. So my poems are like notoriously long. The average spoken word poem is between 2 and 3 minutes. The average Leah V spoken word poem is like 5 minutes, between 5 and 10. So it can be a lot. It can be a lot.
Yeah, I've, in preparation for the conversation, I've heard a number of, well, and me being a fan, but I've heard a number of your pieces. Yeah, and it is amazing that your memorization is the way that it is, how you approach learning to memorize your longer pieces. It's, yeah, not too many people, I'm sure, can do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I think if people, those spoken words can surprise themselves if they should try, right? But I think, you know, a feature is only so many minutes. They want to break down their allotted time and show an array of work. So I think in a lot of ways, it makes more sense to have shorter poems. But I did, I do try these days to write, to count my minutes a little, to be a little bit more particular in my butchering process, which is what I call my editing process, in order to keep it under 5. You know, we're at like a solid 4 right now, but it really all depends. It really all depends on the day. It does take me a long time to finish one piece, though. So I take my time, and memorizing, I don't push it either.
Now, when you say finish a piece, do you mean preparing the piece, writing the piece after all of the butchering that you do? Or do you mean, when you say finish it, do you mean performing it, or both?
I think a sense of both. So like finishing it, I think that there is a mini celebration that comes with the finalization of a piece when you finally put down, you know, you take off the kitchen gloves, you know. Okay. And you wash your hands and you step back, even though you wanna keep carving at it, but you know you have to step back because otherwise you'll edit until the end of days. So I think you have to like know yourself and know when enough is enough, and you can make changes. There was a time in my life where I felt that a poem is finished and it's finished, but that was many years ago. I think now, if I feel that something a few months later that I've been doing differently or want to do differently or change in a piece, I will go ahead and change it. It's not, nobody's stopping me but me when it comes to you know, what is defined as finished. And then the other thing is when I start performing it, I wouldn't call that finished. Like when I start memorizing it, when it's memorized, maybe. I think it's the writing that makes it finish.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the memorization and the performance is like, you get it out the first time, but it's not going to be perfect. I mean, will it ever? So you just have to keep going and going. The moment I have a perfect rendition of a spoken word piece is the moment I think I can call that piece finished, right. Which has never happened, as you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So a piece is always up to be revised if need be.
I think so. I think there was a time in my life, you know, I've been in the New York City poetry scene for quite some time, since right out of college. It's a good like 10 years ago. So I feel like there was a time I was so emotionally invested and so easily offended by any changes or suggestions made to my work. And there was like this, you have to let the baby grow up, though, you know? You have to give them wings to fly. And that's what happens organically. I think now, like, even today, I mean, I have poems in my show, in The Long Way Home, that I've had written since, like, 2018. And these, even before, maybe, I think 2018. Yeah, 2018, 2017, too. Anyway, all that to say, the pieces that I have from there, like, I'm still going back and finishing those, I feel like. Like, I'll still make little changes to them if needed. But everybody has their own, like, trajectory, I think, when it comes to... not trajectory. I feel like as we evolve as people, our writing process is going to continue to evolve. Right. And our performance process at that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then... I guess then you don't throw any of your pieces away then, right? Since they're always up, or do you? Well, since they're always up for revision.
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't say throw them away, but I have pieces that I've done once or twice and never again. I haven't really looked at pieces that I've done once and I thought that's just for me. Mm. There's a never ending perpetuity of unfinished poems that I have forever and ever and ever that will never be finished, but they're not thrown away. They're just sitting there like a hoarder. Right, yeah. You know, I hoard my
I'm the same way. Yeah, I got stuff from 2012 that I haven't finished and I won't, you know. I think that they're just like forever incomplete, but it just feels weird throwing them away or getting rid of them, especially because I handwrite them. And so for whatever the reason, I feel like I can't throw this away. I can't get rid of this. This is, even though it's incomplete, this is my incomplete. Like, this is what I did at this particular point in time. So,
yeah, I love that you handwrite your work too. I feel like there's such a intimacy to the act of, yeah. I mean, I've kept a journal every year of my life since I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I've always written in cursive. But it's also, you know, if I'm having an extra passionate or rather impassioned day, I will like write in both this weird conjoining of both script and regular print. And that goes for poetry too. So I have my journal and then I have my poetry books. And I'll switch over like once the word vomit is out, as I call it. Once the word vomit is out, then eventually I'll transcribe it to work in real time with edits and whatnot. But then when I memorize them, I handwrite it again on my index cards, because I use these colored index cards that with a ring in them that are my pride and joy. So there's a whole lot of handwriting in the process. But the cool thing about my show is that with the discovery of my father's poems, which is the base of the show, that is the central concept of the show, he also wrote his poems in both like cursive and print. So,
and you didn't know that, right? Because you didn't know that he wrote poetry for a while, right?
Yes, and I know I talk about this all the time, but it's just mind-boggling to me, because this man, if there was one thing this man was going to do, it was brag on himself. He was like 100%. So the fact that, you know, he would always talk about him being a trombone player and a ball player and, you know, black belt and what was it, jujitsu and all these different things that he accomplished throughout his life, his career achievements too. So he must not have thought he was very good, or I don't know. I've said that since my father passed in 2020 from COVID, as you know, like, he's always come to me through text, like through written word somehow. Like, if there's a poem that I need to hear or words of advice, it'll fall out of a card from not him, you know. That's or if there's a poem that I'm looking for that I need to find and I can't remember the name of, that has an important message that I need to read it. For whatever reason, but this is something that happens to me. I'm overcome by the need to find a poem. That poem will appear in my inbox. So I feel that he's always come to me through text. And I was still figuring out my show and what I was going to make for the storyline. And in that, he again answered me through text. But I am low key mad still, though, that I didn't get a chance to talk to him about it.
Yeah, especially something that means so much to you, right? And so to be able to bond on that on top of everything else.
He must not have thought he was very good. That's the only thing I can think of.
And he was in his late 20s, early 30s, like the poems that are dated. So right around my age, you know. So it was like, yeah, like it's just it all, everything aligned the way that it needed to. But it is a fascinating thing. I have them all laminated in this binder that I carry around and just read all the time. And we switch some of them out. So we do hear them in my show, in The Long Way Home with Leah V and Friends. There's a few of them read by me and through, it's a multimedia show. We got some sound bites and video and on top of the dancing and the other, and the all the other artistries. And we do switch some of them out. So the encore run this coming Friday is the 24th is definitely not the same show as the first one. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, I saw that the essence of the show is the same, but you have added some different things. And so, well, first, let me just say congratulations on not only the encore, but the first run, because I know that it was something that you had wanted to do for a number of years, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh yeah.
And so mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I know that with the first run you received a lot of love. It was sold out. I guess going into that the first run, mm-hmm. What led you to want to even have a one-woman show? What sparked that interest for you?
I think that I don't even think there was like an epiphany moment. It just always seemed like it was on the to-do list for my performance poetry career. What type of, you know, I love performance poetry. Why not do my entire discography, especially knowing that the length of my poems tends to limit me for certain features. Features would limit the amount of time I would use. So ever since I first had my first off-Broadway feature at the Triad Theater in 2019, I knew from that very first one that is where I wanted to have my one-woman show someday. And I do think that, like, at that time, I had wanted and I had imagined that I would do it sometime in the next couple of years. I didn't imagine waiting. But I'm so happy I did. And I'm so happy that COVID forced me to, you know, because it really was the cause for all delays in all parts of my life for years. But the magic that has come from it was worth waiting for. And it's not just, I wear many hats, right, for The Long Way Home. So, like, I wrote the entire design. I designed everything. I wrote the entire script. I handpicked the poets. I put together all the set pieces. I fundraised myself. I figured it all out. I made the design and the concept and so on and so forth. It's, like, really my brainchild with the help of my dad. I'm so happy that I was able to put to wait, because those 7 years of producing other people's shows at the Triad Theater allowed me to learn the theater intimately and its capabilities, as well as develop the amazing relationship I have with the team over there, from my head of videography to the manager, Gene Castle, to Ben, our tech guy, who's amazing. Like, it's just, I have such great relationships. So I was really able to get crazy creative and like, who's going to stop me, you know? So it was all a product of years of developing trust and a healthy business relationship on top of a healthy, mutually beneficial, creative relationship with the theater and the team. And also through my own growing up, you know, leaving my full-time career a couple years ago, I left my full-time career as a recruiter in finance. And like these last couple of years where I've just been sitting here and grinding it out and teaching myself different things to make my life easier so that I don't have to pay other people to do it. It all kind of came together. So it's really
my brainchild. I call the long way home my baby. It's the only one I have.
How I imagine, of course, that is very time consuming to put in all of the work that you have done, especially since, you know, a lot of it you're doing yourself. But how difficult was it? Was it a difficult, or has it been a difficult process? Because it's still ongoing, right? You still, like, even with the encore show, I'm sure that there was work that needed to go into that as well. Probably some of the same type of work that went into the first run. And so how difficult was it?
Man, that is a weighted question. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I had the date for months, but I was really working under pressure the last go round. It was just, life was crazy for me inside, like in my career and in all the other aspects of my life. There was a lot of changes going on. I'm at a point of transition. That's what I would say during those few weeks. And, you know, the holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then The Long Way Home, the first they debut was January 10th. So it was just a busy time that I didn't think of. I didn't think of any of those factors when I picked the date or anything. I just knew that if I didn't get the date and if I didn't pull the trigger, that I was never going to do it. And I didn't want to keep waiting. I knew that I had everything I needed. I knew that I had the people that would help me put on a good show as well. Because I always call it it's my not so one woman show, since I have so many features and people involved. And I think that's fitting. If anybody knows me, they know that I feed off community. So like, what would a Leah V show, quote unquote, one woman show, wouldn't be a Leah V show if it didn't also share platform with other artists. But when it comes to like the time it took, it was, I was definitely, I was working at it very, very slowly and then all at once, because I received my father's poems, like, it was like the end of October, like mid to late October. And the show was in January 10th, the beginning of January. So it was just, it was really a time crunch. So that I completely recrafted the entire show from scratch, essentially, when I got those. So that in itself was very difficult. And then I think the last couple weeks going into it, there was a lot of sleepless nights for sure. A lot of perfecting, because every detail is really intentional in New York City poetry / grief / train based. Everything from like the playbills to the save the dates to the set pieces, so even what we're wearing or what I'm wearing. And so like, it was definitely the hardest thing I ever did. I will say that this time, and it's always going to be the hardest thing I ever did, even beyond the encore, because there is this sense of cringe when it comes to putting on a one person show. Like, it's like, you got to have a big ass head to do something like that. You really dead ass, you got to think that you are that girl, because who the fuck am I? Excuse my language. So who the fuck am I to be able to say, oh, I deserve this, you know? But it felt right. So there was the imposter syndrome was eating at me those last few weeks. But now you can't tell me when it comes to that. I'm not saying like I'm the bee's knees out here, but I'm the bee something. You know, I feel it's not even about flexing on anybody. It's about, I feel that I've created this living, breathing thing that goes beyond the scope of what I even thought it was going to be. I was so upset on the details, on making everything flow and have a story arc, that I didn't even know it was going to be all out until I saw the live edit the next day. So this go around is infinitely easier because the brunt of the work is done. A lot of the configuring when it comes to the set pieces and how it works and how to do it even is done. But there's a lot of changes too, and I think that's like
And I hope, I mean, God willing, it'll turn into a series. I hope that each one does challenge me in a different way, but we'll see.
Yeah. Now, it's described as a love letter to love, memory, lineage, and loss. And as you mentioned, it is built around your father's words, his poems, and his journal entries. So what was it like to step into that material, not just as a writer and a performer, but as his daughter, especially knowing that you didn't even know for a long time until almost right before the show was to air, well, not air, but January the 10th when it was supposed to debut his first run. But what was it like to step into that material?
Man, that's a weighted one as well. That is a weighted one as well. And I love that you asked me that because it's been such a long time since I thought about it in that context. but it's nice to be brought back to the root, truly. So I think the discovery came at the exact moment I needed it to come. I'll tell you that. Because as always, he comes to me when I need it. And even when I don't know that I need it. I was, again, I'm at a point of transition. I got married a year ago, and we had moved into a new spot. I was reconfiguring some things in my career. I was reconfiguring a lot of things in my personal life and the people that I wanted to spend my sacred time and space with. And also, I was, my mother had just moved out of New York for the first time, my widowed mother, since she came here from Puerto Rico. She moved to DC to be with a couple of my older brothers and their kiddos, like the angel saint lady she is. But it was also the first time in my life that I haven't had her, you know, this is a whole life, right? Being an adult woman and a newlywed navigating many points of transition, as I keep mentioning, I think not having her within reach was tough. So it changed. It was a tough time. It was growing pains. Good problems, but problems nonetheless. You know what I mean? So when I received these poems at that time, the first one that I read is the first one that I read in the show, called Bad Luck, Bad Luck, Confessions of Mr. Waldemar Gonzalez. And it is just a stunning, it's still to this day my favorite one of his that I've read. And it is just a stunning piece of work. And it's heart-wrenching. And he's hurt. And he's dogging on himself. And he's depressed. And he's being cruel to himself. And he had no idea that he was going to live this big, beautiful, grandiose life. So, like, it was, even in all of its darkness, which I loved, by the way, because, hello, you're in your 20s. There's a lot to be dark about. And when I first started out, a lot of my poetry was all depression-based. It was depression and erotica. That's what my poems were when I first started doing spoken word. So, like, to receive that from him and for it to be good on top of that blew my mind. Like, he was using alliteration. He was using internal rhyme scheme. I mean, he was playing around with punctuation, with capitalization. There was a flow. He had callbacks. Like, there was a little refrain. It was just, it's really, there's sarcasm. And it really is a rhythmic, stunning piece of work. And all of his poems are short, which is just the irony there. So I was just, I think as his daughter, it made me just feel so much closer to him. And it also was still my dad coming to me and giving me advice at the same time. Like, because you read this and you're like, well, he ended up having this beautiful, grandiose, fulfilling life full of family and love and passion, even through all of his darkness. And he had a lot more, far more than I ever did. And so I think it was just what I needed. I think, though, that after this show,
when I finally sit down and get to intimately share it with my family in a way that I haven't, because low-key I've been holding on tight to them, to the poems for myself, I think then it'll be a new exploration of like the familial dynamic of what that means, of what my dad's poems mean. I'm sorry, I was just going on and on and on and on. I could talk about those all day.
Please, yeah. People would rather hear you than me, so. So please. Was there anything that you discovered about him through that process of reading his words that you didn't know?
Well, no, I think it was he's a poet's poet, right? There's not a literal details in there in his poems anyway. Like he's cryptic on purpose, and he's good. He's a quality poet, so he's not saying things in a literal pretty manner. He's cryptic on purpose, and it's a beautiful thing. But it is a lot of what I imagined, minus the emphasis on some of the darker, like, depression. But there's a lot of heartbreak, there's some love, there's, you know, there's a lot of woman based things, and I think that tracks all of that. And I also think that there was a lot of philosophy, you know. He didn't always write about himself. He was out of body. Like, he was talking about big concepts from in different eyes. He has a poem called Two Children of Eden that's like sort of about Adam and Eve, but not really at all. He also has like a mini story called A Discussion with God, where God is like a misogynist capitalist, and like not my dad, but there's a character who's talking to God as this misogynist capitalist. He was a wild child, my father. He was very creative. I just wish I had a chance to talk to him about it. But he was definitely like way beyond that of anything I could have imagined, but also still very, very familiar at the same time.
Yeah.
For sure.
I've heard you say that getting over the loss of a loved one doesn't get easier. We just get better at dealing with it. Mm-hmm. Does this project change your relationship with the grief?
Yeah, yes, but I had to change my relationship with the grief for the project to change its relationship with the grief. And unfortunately, I fucking hated when people would tell me this in the first couple of years. In time, it gets easier. Like, I fucking hated it. I was like, why are you saying this now? You are not providing a solution, and you are not validating me in any way. I don't want it. And a lot of the times you don't want it to feel lighter. Correct. I feel that there was unjust, like an unjust act, you know, and because of the complicated grief that comes with COVID loss, like, and the politics involved with it for during that time, and then for the years to come, like the manner in which that death occurred, and the freak fucking global pandemic, isolated, alone, no visitors around, like no body, no closure, extremely rapidly, like not being able to be together with my family while this decline is happening, and we can't do anything. Like, it's really the darkest thing. Like, I don't want to say the darkest thing, but it is some dark shit. So I feel like, then I used to hate when people would tell me that, but here I am 6 years later, and I know for a fact that it's true, right? Like, which is a beautiful thing, hauntingly beautiful, that it does get better. But you also have to make a conscious choice. I still struggle to write about my father in a, in like a happy, positive way. I'm in the process of working on a poem now, but like, I almost always have to mention or end up writing back to his sickness and his death because it's still so unfinished for me, right? So, like, I think that he kind of forced my hand with this show by coming to me with these poems. And those poems made me look beyond, had to make me look beyond that of his death and explore an entire part of his life, an entire identity of his that he hadn't, that I hadn't even thought of. Because how often do we think about our parents in all of their years before we were thought, right? It's not something that, I mean, it wasn't for me. So he kind of forced my hand. So I guess, you know, it's not so much that that I changed my relationship with grief, but my dad, as always, came down and forced my hand. And I think his poems changed my relationship with the grief. And that's a beautiful realization, actually. So thank you for that. Thank you very much.
Now, outside of this run or the long way home itself, do you have aspirations to act professionally, whether it's plays, movies? Do you have, is that a goal for you?
Well, I grew up doing community theater, actually, in the Bronx, and up until college when my vocal notes ruptured. I was always on stage. I was always going to be on stage. It took me to poetry, which I'd also been writing my whole life. I just didn't connect the dots until later on. But I don't know about acting, because I think right now I feel that The Long Way Home is not finished. I don't want it to be finished. I think that it's a living, breathing thing that I can change and alter. And I'm pretty obsessed with it right now. So I feel that that's my focus, you know, definitely my focus. But I do think that I have other aspirations for sure. Things and compilations that need to come out, and I definitely need to make one. I'm actively working on one with my dad's poems as well. But everything right now, I'm so caught up in what I like to call the trainiverse, that, you know, I'm just gonna keep on keeping on. Because the idea, because I waited so many years to do this quote, not so one woman show, because I waited so many years, it's like I have access to such a beautiful array of artists of all kinds, from dancers to actors themselves to God knows how many poets. So I feel that that this is my aspiration for the foreseeable future, and I'm hoping that I can continue to play around with it, to flex it, to push it and pull it, and I'll know when it's working and when it isn't. But yeah, it is my aspiration.
Well, one of the reasons why I asked that question is there's another creative out of New York who's an actress who says that typically the greats, actresses, actors, they have their own one person show, and that it's good to have that done in the chamber. And so I was just wondering if you had thought of if that, in addition to this being a project that you felt needed to be done personally, if that also was part of the thinking, that you may be able to use that or that you intended to use that if you had decided to venture into acting. Again, whether it's plays, movies, that type of stuff.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. But, you know, it's very much me up there for The Long Way Home, you know? It's a version of me, many versions of me, but it's my work. So even though there's this alternate universe, I haven't really thought of, like, acting beyond that. Although I will say that a lot of The Long Way Home was inspired by John Leguizamo's one-man Broadway shows. But even those, he's playing the characters of his family, and he's also playing himself. So I don't know, maybe someday if that's something that somebody wanted to ask me to do, but I got these poems and they keep on coming. So Leovie's got her hands full right now, but maybe someday.
Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that you were recently married. So congratulations on that as well. What was that experience like for you, planning something that personal in public? Are you someone that typically just trusts the process and let everything play out? What was that experience like for you planning a wedding?
Well, luckily the wedding was a year before. Was a year before the long way home. Thank God. I would not be able to do both of those because we got married in Puerto Rico and it was DIY long distance. Don't recommend it ever. But it was still beautiful, beautiful. I mean, I call it one of the most beautiful shows I ever put on, right? It's like, and it was very much that, you know, we had a very choreographed first dance. We had the works. But I have found that my husband and I, when it comes to things of this magnitude, like he's got his job and I have my job. And a lot of the time it's best not to mix church and state. So, you know what I mean? So he gives me just the right amount of space. I mean, it took us time to get there, to find that balance, for sure. But and it's still taking time, you know? We're learning every day. It's really hard, like everything else is, you know? Anything worth having. And so, but the more we continue to learn each other as we both evolve, the more it works. But, you know, that man's busy, so he's supporting me, and he's busy doing his job, and I'm doing mine too, you know? It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I think that's important, the idea of working to find that balance. I think a lot of times, now, to be transparent, I'm not married, but all too often it feels like people or couples look at marriage as the destination, that once they get married, they don't have to put in the work anymore because they've worked their way up to the marriage. But I believe essentially what you were saying is that you still have to work, that you still have to work to find that balance.
Which was like something like learned through trial and error, by the way, you know.
I see that he proposed on stage, well, while you were on stage.
He did.
And I love the answer that you gave him after grabbing the mic while your audience was cheering for you.
Oh, my God.
You said, yes, of fucking course.
Yeah, I was blacked out. And I wasn't drunk. It was just I was beside myself. First of all, like at that feature, I was debuting some like really heavy poems about my dad and about COVID, like very dark stuff that I hadn't done. So I was really in my own head for a lot of it, trying to get it done. And I was just so thrown.
Yeah.
I was just so thrown. But he in the beginning, when marriage first came up in conversation, he always said that he would propose on stage. He's not a poet himself. Although he's an artist in his own right, but he plays a nasty blues guitar, but he's not a
creative.
So he's a creative, but not an artist. But it does help. It does go a long way. I'll tell you that.
And so did you have any sense that the proposal was coming? Maybe not at that particular moment, but did you have a sense that a proposal was coming, or were you completely caught off guard?
No, I knew it was coming. We had gone to get me ringside like sometime a few months before. Like, he had a general idea of the concept of the ring I wanted, but I didn't want to like give him an exact anything. I wanted him to be creative. He did a great job. He did a wonderful job. So I definitely knew. And the thought had even crossed my mind that it would happen that night. But, you know, I'm a poet-ass poet, and I was very concerned with myself and my work. I was not thinking about that man. But it was that much more beautiful. And, you know, we had a packed house. It was sold out. And we went to the place next to the Triad we always go to after shows, and all our family and friends were there, and they had hung up some pictures.
It was cool. Yeah, it was nice when I saw the video. I saw it posted on your on your Instagram account. So we were talking again off air, and I had mentioned to you that I first became a fan of your work back in 2020 when I discovered, came upon the virtual open mic that you hosted with friend of the podcast, Jay Rose. Will you talk about virtual voices and how important it was for you at that particular point in time in 2020, and then talk about Jay Rose? And we were giving her flowers in private.
Yes, for sure. So I will tell the tale. I love that you said giving her flowers, because like I'd be giving her flowers in real life. We actually have a running joke, like physical flowers. I'll send her flowers sometimes. We have this like running joke that, like, you know, Jay Rose is single. We have this running joke that the next man she finds has to like treat her better than I do, and I treat her pretty well. So I'll be popping up on my girl. I'll be giving her gifts. I'll shower her with all the compliments and affirmations she needs. That's my rider. But it's a running joke now, and it's pretty.
So you set the bar.
You know, I'm saying all those. And listen, Big Brother be watching. So watch your algorithms. Going to start showing you the reels of this exact situation. Actually, we made one together recently where I sang, what is that song? All the Things Your Man Won't Do.
About Joe?
Yeah, it's like, it's funny. It's like when we're off the call, take a look. It's like we collaborated on a post like a couple months ago. That shit is hilarious. Anyway, so Jay Rose, Jay Rose and I were both hosting. She had the Rose Garden events at that point, and she was just full throttle curator. She was writing, but she was really mainly businesswoman, mainly running the Rose Garden events. And at that time, she was doing everything by herself, you know, as well as being a mother. But for the Rose Garden events, like now she has a wonderful, wonderful team. But back then it was solo dolo. And like I was working for a couple different series, but I was definitely predominantly artist. But I was getting my hosting bag as well. Jay Rose and I crossed paths. Like we didn't get to like formally meet, but we had seen each other hosting at a couple different events. And we both liked each other's, which we discuss later. We liked one another's energy. We're both very high energy, happy, and very grounded, but very like positive and very observant. So I think we were both felt that we had some momentum when lockdown started, and we had a previous mutual friend who ended up connecting us because both of us made like a Facebook status or something that said like, I want to host a virtual open mic. And that is actually, and the concept seems crazy now. Like, I knew we knew of each other, but I feel like working with just somebody random who on the internet, such a funny concept. But that's actually how we became, not only started working together, but how we became friends, because neither of us knew that my father was going to catch COVID at the end of the month. He actually watched the first virtual voices. He was living in Lower Westchester with my mom, and he not only caught, and he was extremely healthy. He not only caught COVID, but was in the hospital a week later, you know, on a ventilator a week after that, and dead less than 2 weeks after that. I mean, it was a really freak fucking thing, and there's no way to talk to him. There's no closure. Everything was overcrowded. It was a nightmare. But Jay Rose and I had virtual voices. Now, I did it for as long as I could. Luckily, shout out to Gaia. We had Gaia step in and hold it down during that time. But virtual voices ended up running. I mean, by the time we stopped them all together, it was like summer 2022 or 2023 or something. Like, we were still trying to do it at least bi-monthly. We were really committed. But at the peak of it, I had moved back home to my mother's house after my father passed, and you know, I was going through the worst time of my life, but it was not only my saving grace and allowed me to develop this best friendship and this beautiful, we call each other creative partners in creative crime relationship that I have with Jay, but also, you know, it was just, it provided a safe space for everybody, as you and I were speaking about off air, right? Like, it's a platform that kept getting better. So we would take notes and we would think of things. And what would happen is you could watch it on Facebook without recording, without being a viewer, and we could pin comments. So like you can give, speaking of giving flowers, you can give people their flowers on whatever they're doing, like their virtual snaps, as we would call them. And, you know, the different things that they were like, and Jay and I have such a beautiful creative chemistry. Like it's really something magical. And it was global, you know, because everybody was in lockdown. So, or partial, you know, so, we had people in Canada, we had people in India. I still have friends. I think we both actually still have several friends that we met through there who are either in the city or from different states. Our favorite musician, Balin, who I believe is on the East Coast now, but I don't even remember what state he was in. Anyway, that's just an example of like the global nature of it. There was this DJ dude in Malaysia who used to do these sick video effects. There was this like dad and his kid in like Singapore, and there was a couple guys in India who were tuning in the next day. And like at the peak of it, Jay and I were just really moving and grooving, as I say. And it was not only the beginning of a, like I said previously, a beautiful lifelong creative collaboration that I will have with her. And it is lifelong. I'll tell you why. Because she's never getting rid of me. But also, she, Jay Rose, is the conductor in The Long Way Home. Mm. Which was originally supposed to be somebody else and things didn't work out. But that's that universe, right? That's that universe, because who else am I going to call in the last hour, you know, the last week, who cannot and will not say no to me, you know, who I knew was going to be there anyway, right? And she has made it so special. And this run is particularly special with her in it because of the additions for her role, if you will. I don't want to give too much away. But yeah, Virtual Voices was what got us there. And now she's stuck with me until death do us part. But also we have a deep respect for one another's artistry, you know, and that's a beautiful thing. Like we get very hype when we hear one another do poems. I'll be like, girl, I'm working on this. Like, and I think that's the most beautiful thing about our friendship is to be able to feel like you have somebody who you mesh well with, who you respect and admire, and who, you know, it's just across the board. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And I was telling you how important she is to me when it comes to this podcast, and how she was gracious and helpful and allowed me to promote what I was doing on her platform. And when I first started, how she would promote it and she would share my post. And so, yeah.
She's just the best.
She is. She is, for sure. I was excited to see that about a month ago, really, I think for the first time since Virtual Voices ended, that you two hosted an event together.
I know. Oh, man, it was a good time. And it just made me miss it. Like, it just, you know, we're both full-time artists, but we have such different work, right? And such different schedules, you know? So it's hard to be able to work together as much as we want to, but the ideas never stop coming. I put it on to one of my series, Mike-tastic, which produces shows at the Triumph Theater. We did open mics for a couple of years, but we're on an open mic hiatus just because I'm swamped with theater shows. But Mike-tastic, the last show we did was the FMC5. No, not FMC5. That was the name of the show I was going to do before the world shut down in 2020. So I called this Mouth by Mike-tastic FMC edition, and of some of our favorite artists. And I asked Jay if she could host with me. Just, you know, I could have done it myself the way I always do, but I just thought it would be so much fun. you know, it was all these people who were supposed to be involved in the first showcase that never was in 2020. And so not all of them, but a lot of them. So it was just really beautiful. And we're just so funny together. Like, we are really hilarious. And let it be known here on the Ethically Immoral podcast that Jay Rose has still yet to do a duo poem with me. I'm putting you on blast, girl.
Man.
But it's okay because I have everybody I know applying pressure at all times.
That's good. Yeah. So she can't get away. She was going to be reminded for sure.
The whole audience shouting out duo poem, duo poem. Mm-hmm.
Duo
poem. It was a good time.
So I do want to, just being mindful of the time, I do want to get into your creative history a bit. You talked about it a little bit, but you started, if I'm not mistaken, you started writing poetry around the age of 7. Do you remember what pulled you into poetry that early?
You know, I don't have like a significant moment. I have just been writing my entire life, like, for as far back as I can remember. I taught myself cursive when I was like 5 or 6 years old because in my head I felt like you had to write your diary in cursive. And I've been writing in my cursive version of my cursive ever since. I had a second grade teacher by the name of Sasha Wilson, who ended up being a lifelong family friend to me and my family. He was actually at my debut show, Sasha. He was my second and third grade teacher. He's my brother's boss right now. And he had a big effect on my poetry writing and reading career, like not career, passion for sure. For sure. He definitely helped me feed that and created a space for that. And so, you know, I always tell people that, like, writing poetry stopped being a choice long ago because I tried. I went to college for psychology originally, but I was sitting there in all these science classes writing poems in the margin. It's stopped being a choice long ago, like I said. And I ended up getting a degree in English and professional writing. So I haven't only been writing poetry my whole life, but I've been studying it and reading it. And so it's like, if there was like a poetry-based Jeopardy, I would win the shit out of that. Like, I'm very well-versed in the history of the written form and the spoken form as well, but one goes hand in hand in the other, I think. And I started doing like performance poetry, taking it more seriously after college, doing spoken word, just hitting open mics by myself, just managing a dance school at that time. And the same dance school that brought me the tap dancer who's in my show, The Long Way Home. And it just was the best adrenaline rush I ever received. And I've just been at it ever since. But it definitely stopped being a choice long ago. And I still love to study it. I still love to read it. I think that practicing your craft and loving what you do, going to shows for the poems and not for any other reason, but because you love the poems. Not my show, I mean any show, mm-hmm. is a beautiful thing, you know, it's a beautiful thing. I feel very fortunate to have a purpose because I think people spend their whole lives trying to find that, you know?
Yeah. Did you grow up around, now we know that your dad wrote poetry and...
We know that now, he didn't
write
then.
Right, we know that now, right, yeah. But did you... grew up around creativity? Any of your family members creatives?
Absolutely. Now they were all creatives in their own right, but none of them were ever full time. So like my dad played the trombone and the congas, the bongos. He was always involved in music his whole life. And he definitely fed into my creative needs when I was growing up. I did ballet for many, many years. I was always involved in community theater and dance, you know, shout out to the Bronx Dance Theater, which ended up closing down, sadly. But I was always involved in, I was
I was always around music, so that was his love. And then actually in his later years, when he retired, he decided to learn the piano. He's actually getting quite good when he passed. The keyboard that I use for the show is his keyboard. And I have his drums here too, actually. My mom is a crafter. So the way that my mom dealt with the grief and the weeks alone, the 4 weeks that she was alone while my father was in the hospital and passing and losing his mind, she would go on walks and she would pick up leaves and twigs and things, and she would paste them all together, and she would make beautiful art, and she would paint things and spray things, and she still very much does that. And they were both very culture forward, so we were always at museums. They tried to take me to Broadway shows whenever they could. Both my brothers play guitar, my brother Ariel plays some piano, so I was definitely around it. I mean, I was like, I grew up around my four older brothers, so like, I truthfully was around sports more often than not, but they were all still there sitting as close to the front as they could for any dance recital or anything else I was in, so I was very fortunate.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah. Now, after graduating university, I read that you were looking to get into, well, you submitted work to literary magazines in order to get published early on, but because your work really wasn't selected, you then started to focus more on spoken word poetry. Is that right?
I mean, yes and no. So I think that's what led me to start doing open mics, because I was like, fuck it. Nobody's going to tell me no when I'm on stage and I'm paying for my time, right? So it's a one way to cure your rejection blues. But I do think that the school that I was a part of did not provide the advising that was, I felt, more current day than not. You're kind of told that you build a portfolio, you submit for publication. After you graduate, you build your portfolio, submit for publication, and you keep on getting, and you just build your portfolio, and then you eventually can write full time. But you know, I think there's the digital age is actively happening during these years, and like heightening to lengths that know no bounds in terms of free access to writing and poetry, and you can't really make a living that way. So I was pretty lost in the sauce as to what came next for me. Granted, I still get rejected all the time, let it be known, because it comes with the territory. Right, if you can't be a poet, rejected all the time. But it's definitely that rejection, those rejections was definitely what brought me to the stage. It just took me many years to figure out how to make a career of it. I'm still figuring it out too, you know, I'm very much so, but like, I'm much in a much better place than I once was, but it was a long journey to get here, a long way home, if you will.
And so what were you looking to do? So you were looking to be a full-time writer?
Oh, I don't know. In college, I don't know. I don't think I knew what I wanted to do. I was just trying to survive, I think. Those years were tough, tough, tough when it came to my mental health, for sure. Definitely tough, tough, tough. And also I think I just didn't want to grow up, like so many of us don't want to when we leave college.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I think I was also still figuring out very much who I was, you know, which I'm blessed to be able to say that I still am figuring out who I am, but, I know my core, you know, and I know my heart. And I think that you have to know yourself before you know what you want to do for the rest of your life. But I was just always doing open mics. I was involved in a couple different series. I started curating after a few years, but I managed a dance and fitness school for a few years after college. And then I stumbled into finance administration, which stumbled on up to HR, which stumbled into fintech finance recruiting. And it was just quite the road to get here, to figure it out. But I had no idea back then what I wanted to do at all.
Going back to the long way home, you talked about having friends that were assisting or that would be performing with you. Who are some of the other creatives that are part of the performance?
Well, we have my right-hand man, Shaq, Shaking the World, known to the masses, who is my guitarist, singer, fellow train writer. He's really one of my favorite creative collaborators. He's been doing a lot of the back end work with me, and he really is my sounding board when it comes to ideas with the show, but also an incredibly gifted musician who is just always down with the get down. Alongside Current, who is my other music man, Current of the Keys. I've been working with both of them for some years now. And I'm also really blessed to be able to call them both two of my very, very good friends. Very good friends. Those are my music people. Then we got our dancers. I have my tap dancing friend, Miss Alex. I call her Miss Alex because when I used to work at the dance school, because she's a teacher. She teaches like a million hours a week of all types of dance, not just tap dance. She's well-versed, very well-versed, and she's brilliant. And then we have Kitty, who is a poet friend. I met her through the poetry scene in New York City, but she was in the Rose Garden freshman class last year. But she was, I don't know, we just like became friends pretty organically, I feel. So she does the pole dancing, and she's also going to be doing a poem this for the encore run. And she's a brilliant, brilliant artist as well. And then I have five feature spotlight poets, four of which are returning from the first show. We got one new person coming in. And what happens is that I allow the spotlight poets to pick what stop they want to be on, because each stop there's a series of stops on the train, and each represents a different theme, so I allow them to pick their stop, and then we kind of weave it into the rest of the program. And there's a lot of people involved on the back end too, but everybody's a poet. That's the best part about it. Everybody's from my creative director, co-collaborator Anubis, to my right-hand manager. I call her my life manager, not just my stage manager, Jasmine. And of course, we got J Rose in the mix. So it's a really beautiful thing to be able to have so many members in the community, many of which have their own series, who are down to be a part of this and join me on the subway ride, if you will.
I do want to say, too, now I don't live in New York, so I live in Wisconsin, I live in Milwaukee, but I do want to say that there is something about New York's poetry community, the spoken word, performance, page, poet community, all of it, that is, to me, special. Like I said, I don't live there, but I can feel it when having, you know, this platform and being able to talk to different creatives. Will you talk about how special New York is when it comes to community and support for fellow creatives? And then if the uniqueness of New York, because I do think that even though there's support everywhere, but it's just something unique about New York. So it has that shaped you as a performer?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very New Yorker nowhere. I mean, the entire show takes place in the subway ride. So it's like I'm very obsessed with, even now, the bittersweetness of New York City. I try to find the sweet more than the bitter. And I think that applies to the poetry community as well. Because like any shared space, there's always going to be a plethora of upbringings, which contribute to a plethora of personalities, and some don't always mesh well with others. I also think that sometimes people can think it's like every other area of New York City, it's an oversaturated scene right now. But that's okay. You know, it's like I said before, it's good problems to have. I'm an extrovert and like, the most definitive sense of the word, to be honest. Like I will recharge my body being around other people. Yes, especially other poets and other artists. So even with all the chaos and even with all the bitter that comes with the sweet, I've made my whole life within the New York City poetry scene. And everybody from people who I've known and people who I know now and people who I will know, have contributed greatly to my journey. And it's become so much more than just a workspace. Now, you can't allow the poetry scene to be your whole life, but I have met some of my, actually the majority of my best friends ever at this moment from the New York City poetry scene. So I'm blessed in that capacity for sure. I'm very New York or nowhere, you know, very New York or nowhere, no matter what. And who knows, maybe the long way home will continue to expand and we can tour to other states. Hey, we can go to Wisconsin and, yeah, and get you up on the, you know, I had a vision of getting different posts from different states on there. But at the end of the day, it's always the show acts as a love letter, not just to lineage and love and loss, but to the city itself. You know, the city is very much the other person, the other character, as it is in all of our lives. So there's definitely something special, as I'm sure everybody feels about their respective places. But I think of New York, I think of bittersweet, I think of sweet and sour, I think of oxymorons, I think of complexity, but I think of never leaving. And that stands for me and my role in this community, no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely think about Wisconsin if you take the show on the road, for sure.
I would love that.
I would too. Even if it's Chicago, because I'm not too far from Chicago, about an hour from Chicago. So even if it's like Chicago, be like, hey, Mike, going to Chicago, you in?
And I'll let you know. You would be the first person I called if we make it out there.
There we go. All right. I'm going to write that down so it's in writing. All right, just a couple more questions before you let me go here. Mm-hmm. I saw that you had the opportunity to perform on stage at the Apollo Theater about a year or two ago.
Yes, one of my proudest moments.
Yeah, so was that the first time that you performed there? And how was it? How was it being on that stage?
It was the first time that I performed there. The only other time I could have ever gotten the chance to was if I did amateur night, and I just never did it. Maybe one day I will still, you know, like so many others have tried. But I also, so it was definitely, it was the first time that I performed there. And it was iconic for many reasons. First of all, Poetry Me Please is such a big part of my journey, and PMP and Rush and the team have contributed greatly to my growth. Now people have their thoughts on any of the bigger series. I think people, there's always going to be thoughts. It's like, you know, more platform, more problems, if you will, which I too have learned myself. But I am always going to stand 10 pens down when it comes to PMP and the spaces that they've allowed me to grow into, and the journey and their contribution to not just my journey as an artist, but my healing journey. Because in 2020, it was like June of 2020, I went to the Harlem bomb shelters protest in the streets, open mic, outside, this is after George Floyd was killed, outside of the Apollo, and I performed a poem known as O2 there, O, 2, as in like oxygen with the 2 on top, like the element, the chemical element, but also like O2, like, oh, another one, because it's spelled COO. So I like to explain these things because double entendres are a big part of my work. Mm-hmm. But I ended up performing that poem with PMP at the Apollo. So it was a real full circle moment some 3-4 years later after I first had it down, and it was by far like the proudest moment of my life. So definitely shout out. I mean, and it was a beautiful thing. You know, they have all the artists sign one of the walls going up the staircase, and you see all these different big names. Like, I know, I remember seeing her signed. Mm-hmm. And then her came back, her, and signed again next to her the first time she wrote. And she was like, I'm back 10 years later, but this time I'm a headliner. And it was just like, so motivating, you know. But definitely shout out to PMP and Rush and the team for putting poetry in spaces that putting us on game, you know, and putting us in spaces that we don't normally get to access. And I've done a lot of stages. I've done a lot of universities. I've done a lot of eclectic random places, but that is not one I have done, and it is definitely one of my proudest moments.
Nice. And then I would be disrespectful to the Triad Theater if I didn't ask about the Triad Theater, since the name has come up a couple of times today. So will you talk about its significance to you?
Yeah, so I started performing with the Triad through another series way back when. My first feature was March of 2019. And I featured and hosted there a bunch for many years. And then eventually when I started my own series in 2023, I reached out to them and I started my variety series there. Now the same man, John Frisch, who used to do my videography, because we get the footage through the cameras that are around the theater. It's actually a beautiful work. But the guy who used to do my videography now runs that department. So that just goes to show how long we've known each other. He's near and dear to my heart, and I've developed quite a great relationship with the manager of the theater, Jean Castle, who's a lifelong choreographer and tap dancer. Brilliant, brilliant, wonderful man. And, you know, he has been a great assistant. It's a beautiful thing to be able to have such a collaborative relationship with this theater, you know, in Manhattan, which is something that I never would have dreamed of growing up, to be real. And there's no end in sight as far as I know. You know, I got a couple more shows booked for them this year, and it's looking like we're going to have some more. So shout out to the team.
Absolutely. All right. So four quick rapid fire questions before, again, you let me go. First question is, if you could describe yourself in five words, and it could be on any level, what words would you use?
Impassioned. Goofy.
Okay.
Well read.
Okay.
Verbalist. I don't even know if that's a word, but I have a poetic license. Well, it is now. And if it's not, then it should be. I'm writing it down right now.
Verbalist, yeah. Okay.
Right? I got to get that one down before anybody beats me. So that was what, four?
Four, yeah.
I don't know. I think the last one would be human. I mean, those are the most general things I can think of. But I think I try to be as human as possible, and I wear my heart on my sleeve, but I don't try to be something I'm not to anybody. And, you know, evolving, maybe evolving is better than human. Let's go with that one. Evolving.
Okay. We'll take out human. Okay, cool. Second question is, as a creative, what inspires you?
A better question is, what doesn't inspire me? I'm blessed to have never experienced this thing that people speak of called writer's block. That's not like a thing for me. I firmly believe I can write about anything. But I do also often say, bad for the heart, good for the art. So I think turmoil inspires me, as it does with everybody else, unfortunately.
How long have you been saying that? That's pretty good, actually.
I think probably since Virtual Voices.
Okay. I'm going to use that. I'll give you credit, but I'm going to use it. So.
Yes, you're more than welcome.
All right, cool. Third question is, where can people find you if they wanted to get to know more about you and everything that you have going on? Where can people find out more about you?
You can catch me on leahvspeaks.com. I keep it fairly updated, and it should be pretty updated now. The Long Way homepage is actively being built out there, so definitely check it out. That's also where you can find tickets to any upcoming performances, including those that I host and produce, and of course, The Long Way Home. And you can follow me everywhere at Leah V Speaks.
Awesome. And then finally, last question is, will you come back? Will you come back and talk creativity, poetry, whatever projects you got going on, or just to come back and chill? Will you come back?
Absolutely. I'm a yapper, and this has been wonderful, especially knowing the origin story of you discovering me. It's a beautiful thing, because I could talk about virtual voices and J. Rose all day. But yes, this has been a wonderful time. I wish you weren't so far away so I could throw you some tickets to my show.
Man, I would love it. I would love that. If I'm ever in New York,
you let us know. Yes, make sure you hit up me and Jay for sure.
Absolutely, I absolutely will. Absolutely will. Well, I appreciate your willingness to come back. If you take a look at our guest list, you'll see that people have come back. So I do ask. So be prepared at some point in time. But Leah, thank you so much again for taking the time out to hang out and talk and share your journey and be vulnerable and be willing to just be willing. I enjoyed you. I appreciate you. And I'm looking forward to the next conversation.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it as well. This has been great, and I will come kick it whenever it's clever. You let me know.
This cliche 3 a.m. artistry shit kills me. You mean to tell me there's a certain hour? Hour, as in something concocted, as in someone decided, as in time isn't real, that'll trigger my mental to release seemingly sudden tucked away thought? A reveal of secrets, rather? You mean to tell me there's a certain hour that allows a human to feel so at peace, or perhaps so isolated, that said human is able to delve into their submental and willingly bring their most harrowing hidden places into the general public's thinning view? Because I'm here, and it's 3, and let me tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking lyrical deprivation. And I'm thinking of this blessed articulation. And I'm thinking of physical sensation driving conscious calibration. And I'm thinking of earth evil so real we're nearly enamored by the historic significance. Shout out to our presidents. And I'm thinking phases of transition. And I'm thinking contemplation. And I'm over drinking my contemplation, overthinking my sinking affirmations. And I'm thinking the easy way out. Following elevated linguistic hopscotch, I'm thinking the easy way out. I'm thinking I'm blessed, I should bow out. I'm thinking this right here is the top of the sanctuary that is my ability to place permanence. And I'm thinking I'm not worth this. And I'm thinking I've got infinite verses and eternal expression, yet I'm still questioning my very own purpose. And I'm thinking my pain stain never subsided and it nurtures my narcissism. And I'm thinking this vast vocabulary won't swoop in with a glimmering cape as me the mortal gapes. And I'm thinking I've released too much. I'm thinking as I leave, whenever it is that may be, I'm thinking 3 a.m. strangles me until I'm begging for body space deprivation and reincarnation. And I'm thinking I need to be touched. My Jesus is another flesh against mine. And I'm praying to whoever, whatever, she ever is responsible for your skin encompassing my useless figure. And I'm thinking there is no reason. There is no hour. There are pores and follicles and atoms enclosed onto that of another's, feeding off human withering. And I'm thinking, when I doubt my existence, I'm thinking I need to be touched. I'm thinking we need to be touched. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. And then that alarm electrocutes me. I curse the tangible universe. How dare you deal me this king, then tear me away from his skin prior to sun peaks. Reality proves to mate well with irony. Defies all of the happy ending connections stuffed down our throats since birth. You see, we've discovered the work. You come from country, that of another and that of our own, and you arrive essentially alone. That initial evening conjoining guitar strings, I kept questioning, what's the catch? And the catch is that I've become so attached that all pain points toward you as my medicinal man. The catch is that my intrigue in you is so grandiose that I, me, the most secure amid insecure seas, can't help but to question what in the good name of fuck you found in me. And the catch is, you've never fully given yourself. A mechanical method engineered through the equations of lone wandering wolves. The catch is I'm on edges of all kinds all of the time, peering over and into the unknown, emotions sporadic and shooting through my successes and into your arms when the applause stops and I no longer want the wretched world to see the fillings of this silhouette, when the lights are so bright that my pores peel into aches, when the metaphors minimize and moisten into mold, when relevance grows old, when the artiste can no longer please and all that's left is lengthy, listless LV. It is you who I wish to collapse onto, and majority of the time that's quite literally what I do. I give my 6 a.m. 60 seconds until my locks line your chest like backward wings. I can't help it. I'd rather run to work than miss out on your most majestic of movements. Seemingly effortless like those irises, how they intoxicate me. I want to eat your philosophies. I swim in your knowledge, the vastness, the solidity. But you take two people who express opposingly and you're left with communication messes wherever you go. But best believe we go. I'll take the reactive strength that both hurts and heals when ensued by who you love most. I'll sit over smoke signals of schedules and configure puzzle pieces until my finger bones expire. Tire myself with misunderstandings stemming from misguidance because I'd rather miss the eyelids than to miss more than a millisecond of sweet coexistence. I once told you I'd follow you into the unknown. I've already roamed the length of this city unaware I was looking for you, my human home. Picket fence as hand, windowsill as bone, plumbing as lung, all locked doors sealed shut and left to be undone. Knowing the risk, I still took the fall, or rather the slip we happened to one another. But now we muster muscles for what won't allow growth. We sweat through the work, but we grow. I glow. I welcome inevitable pain. I will it, prepare it, preventative methods for future, and I love you when laid upon hospital bed just as much as I will when you're seated on success's throne. What's ride or die? We transcend. We can fly. We have already flown. After long nights of poetry play, you carry me off couches when I can't carry myself. Too many nights your computer screen blares in languages I can't comprehend, and I wonder, will your evening ever end? You don't seem to intend to finish until your work is done. It inspires me. So I'm fully prepared to proceed in rolling up sleeves, letting the dirt particles build up under fingernails as we create singular space among this unforgiving digital space that isn't kind to those of us who prioritize togetherness the rainbows have left. But the butterflies remain. And perhaps persistence isn't so painful anyway. I mean, after all, music brought us together and the notes proceed to play. I do hope the sheet of chords never dwindle. I pray the bass line perpetuates even when it's too loud. I hope the horns don't lack breath. I hope the keys never stiffen. I hope to be yours, only yours, until the sounds stop, and maybe even after that too. I'll work and I'll rise and I'll work and I'll rise and you'll work and you'll rise and we'll work and we'll rise and best believe we go. Let the wretched world take note of this flow that we own, of this flow that we know, that you know, that I know, only we know. At the end of it all, we are inexplicable. Always into the exhausted other end and onto the unknown. And maybe even after that too. Thank you.
All right, welcome back. So the first poem that you heard is entitled 3 a.m. And the second poem that you heard is entitled Yours, both by our guest, Leah V. As she mentioned, you can visit her website, leahvspeaks.com. Again, leahvspeaks.com. And you can follow her on Instagram at leahvspeaks. Again, at leahvspeaks on Instagram. Now, if you did miss the contact information for any of the performance poets that we featured this week, no problem. You can find that information in the show notes on the website. Just visit our website, ethicallyamoralpodcast.com. Click Volume 7, Chapter Number 4, and the information will be there for you to view. And or if you listen via a podcast platform, the information will be there for you to view as well. All right, so this music means that Volume 7, Chapter Number 4 of the podcast has come to an end. But before I leave, before I get out of here, of course, I want to take time out to thank and express my appreciation to those who have made this chapter possible. First, I want to thank my guest, the incredible Leah V. Leah, thank you so much for hanging out. Thank you for dropping by. Thank you for the great conversation. As I mentioned to you a number of times, I've been a fan of yours for a while. And so I was really looking forward to this conversation, and it did not disappoint, at least not me. Congratulations on all of your success. Congratulations on the second run of The Long Way Home. Now, if you did miss the contact information for Leah, if you missed it the first two times, no worries. You can follow Leah on Instagram at LeahVSpeaks. Again, at LeahVSpeaks on Instagram. And you can visit her website, leahvspeaks.com. Again, leahvspeaks.com. Thanks again, Leah. Looking forward to the next conversation. Next, I want to thank you, the listener, for listening. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to pay us some attention. Always appreciative. Please continue to support the podcast by rating the podcast 5 stars if you truly believe we have earned that rating. Also, make sure you tell your family, your friends, your enemies, and your associates about who we are, what we do, how we do it, and why, so they can become fans of ours as well. And also make sure that you subscribe to the podcast if you listen via a podcast platform, so you know when the next chapters drop. Thanks again for listening. I love you. Next, I want to say what's up and what's good to my writing tribe, the TML writing community. What's up and what's good? Thank you for supporting me, this program, and everything that I do creatively. Most importantly, though, thank you for supporting, encouraging, and motivating one another. I love y'all. And finally, I want to say I love you to my daughter, Victoria. Victoria, I love you. All right, that is it for me. Make sure that you visit our website, ethicallyamoralpodcast.com. Check out our conversations with all of the creatives that we have welcomed. Also, make sure you support us on social media at ethicallyamoral on Instagram, at ethicallyamoral on Threads, at ethicallyamoralpodcast on Facebook, at ethicallyamoralpod on TikTok, and at Poetry and Convo on X. Again, thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. I love you. My name is Mike Payne, and you've been listening to the Ethically Homo Podcast, Volume 7, Chapter Number 4. Talk to you next week.